The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, Judge Larson, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As you know, this panel is holding oral arguments by Zoom today. We have three cases on our calendar. We are recording the oral arguments. Just a reminder to everyone who's watching, no other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. A copy of the audio recording will be available on our website, generally within about 24 hours. For purposes of the recording, today is October 19th, 2023. The first case on our calendar today is A23-1067 in the matter of the civil commitment of Krista G. Leonard. Each party will have 15 minutes for their initial argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer available in the grid view that will show how much time you have remaining. I will ask that each attorney introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. And if I have mispronounced any names, please let me know. With that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. I believe you're muted, sir. The curse can, it's
Curse of technology.
happens to me all the time. You can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Kenneth White, and I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent appellant Krista Leonard in this matter. Initially, let me acknowledge that I have a cold that I'm fighting, and as you may have noticed, I coughed a few seconds ago. I am violating the rules of decorum before this court. I have a cough drop in my mouth in the hopes that I won't have another coughing attack, but if I do, my apologies in advance. Your Honors, as the court has indicated, this case involves the civil commitment of my client, Ms. Leonard. There are really two major issues before the court, but let me begin by simply noting the argument that was made at the beginning of my brief related to the proceedings, and then get into the two major issues, the lack of evidence of harm and the evidence of the less restrictive alternative. The proceedings in this case are a little challenging, and I don't think they rise to the level of a procedural due process violation, but I think they do raise some significant concerns and result in this court doing what has been described as a careful and searching review of the record and the basis on which civil commitment occurred. Primarily, I think the problem here is with the district court's acknowledgement at the conclusion of the case that the judge knew of the of Ms. Leonard prior to the hearing. That was not disclosed in advance, at least not in our record, and was not addressed in any way by the court in terms of what information the judge had, how old it was, what the nature of that relationship was, or anything else.
Mr. Wake, Mr. Wake, I was going to ask you a question related to that. I noticed that the examiner also referenced having a long history or some phrase that she used in her report, but I didn't see anything either in the formal record, meaning the one exhibit that we have and the testimony, but also I did look at the petitioner and the petition itself and the examiner's report that seemed accompanied that. And I can't remember what other document early on in the case, but I did not see any evidence related to prior history of mental illness or commitment. Did I miss it, or is that correct? There's nothing in the record so indicating.
You are correct, Your Honor. There is nothing in this record. And that's one of the issues that I raise in terms of the nature of the proceedings that leads me to the careful and searching review of the record requirement that I think this court needs to undertake. There is the reference in the examiner's report to having prior interaction with Ms. Lennard, but nothing about the nature and extent of that prior interaction, and similarly with the district court judge. So we are left with a 30-minute hearing, one exhibit, that being the examiner's report, and two witnesses, the examiner and Ms. Lennard. And given that record and the careful and searching nature here, I think under our de novo standard of review that exists in our argument here, this court must reverse and remand the case for further proceedings. So let me, if the court does not decide to simply dismiss it, and there's a long discussion or a long quotation from the Jenkins case, which is a criminal matter, admittedly, but I think it does give this court some guidance in terms of the possibility of simply dismissing the matter, the civil commitment, given the various violations that that may have occurred, given the nature of the record and the judge's acknowledgement of having some interaction, but an undisclosed interaction. So let me turn to the merits of the two arguments. First, Your Honor, as the court is aware, there is no dispute here that Ms. Lennard suffers from mental illness. The nature of that illness, the expert testimony is that it includes bipolar disorder. Ms. Lennard denies that in her testimony, but certainly the district court judge in finding she suffered from bipolar disorder, there is evidence in the record to support that, and we do not challenge that finding on appeal. The challenge here, though, Your Honors, is to whether or not the evidence that was submitted rises to the level of clear and convincing evidence of Ms. Lennard facing imminent harm to herself or others. And in that context, Your Honors, there are basically three kinds of arguments that are made by the county and or findings by the district court judge, which may have some application. First is the incident in Winona that led to Ms. Lennard being placed into custody and taken to the Winona hospital. The evidence is undisputed that she had a cut on her arm and that she had smeared blood on her face, that she was yelling and at customers, and that she was lighting candles on the floor, and that when the officers gave her a no trespass order, she lit that on fire as well. The problem here, though, Your Honors, from the record is there's nothing in any of that that suggests that Ms. Lennard, because of those or of that conduct, was at imminent risk of harm to herself or others. We know nothing about the cut.
Would you agree that there doesn't have to be evidence of actual harm to or the court to determine that that standard is met? Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Your Honor. I didn't mean to cut you off. I thought you were finished.
No, I guess that's my first question. Why don't you go ahead and answer that? Thanks.
I would agree, Your Honor, that on a generic level, you do not have to wait until someone commits serious bodily harm or significant property damage. But again, the statute requires it be imminent or highly likely to occur. And I don't think this record gets you there.
And the record does reflect that she cut herself.
Yes, Your Honor.
And set a paper to fire in a business. Why isn't the combination of those two sufficient to meet the standard where, cutting oneself is harmful to oneself, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the record suggests that she did it at the suggestion of God. So isn't wasn't the court properly concerned that there could be much more serious harm of cutting in the future or a more serious harm of fire in the future?
Well, Your Honor, I think that is the kind of, I think that's the kind of speculative conclusion that this court and the Supreme Court in the past have not allowed district courts to reach. There is, I mean, a cut is an undefined term. A paper cut will bleed. A very minor cut on her arm, and we don't know where on her arm it was even, a very minor cut on her arm will bleed and is not necessarily harmful. All of us have had cuts. I've got a pretty nasty scrape on my forehead today that haven't caused us any significant harm. And similarly, candles and lighting a piece of paper is not indicative of a significant future risk of harm. And so to jump from that conduct to significant risk of harm, I don't think is allowed under the case law this court has adopted.
Is the bigger issue in this case that the findings are insufficient?
Well, Your Honor,
is
yes.
Is that the real, you know, the first hurdle here, that without sufficient findings, there isn't a basis to conclude that the standard was met?
Well, Your Honor, I would flip that on its head, if you will, and argue that the first step this court should undertake is an analysis of, even given the record, does it meet the standards for harm to self or others? And is there a evidence of a less restrictive alternative and a basis upon which the district court could reject it? You look at the entire record, but certainly the findings in this case are minimal at best, and I think insufficient ultimately for this court to undertake significant appellate review, given the nature of those findings. I mean, the finding of the basis for civil commitment simply recites the statute. It doesn't tell you what actions, which this court has required specific actions, led to the specific conclusion. So connecting the dots, if you will, you were trying to do, Judge, between the lighting of the ticket on fire and the cut on the arm, those are dots the district court judge never expressly drew, either in the oral findings or in the written findings. The judge simply says there's a risk of imminent harm, and I adopt everything that the examiner's report says.
Mr. Wade, can I clarify then, because this probably does tie into the standard review, you mentioned de novo, but yet normally with findings, of course, we would look for clear error. And the conclusion would be the abuse of discretion in terms of whether the record supports the findings, which supports the conclusion. So it kind of tracks that way. But when you said you flipped it on its head, your point being, unlike a normal situation where we might be able to have a hard, we might say we reverse and remand if we agree with you because the findings do not provide for meaningful review. Your point being is, separate from that, the record simply doesn't support it in any event, even if the findings had more particularity, because at least then we could review it. But you're saying that the record wouldn't support it under any scenario, at least if I understand correctly, with regard to harm. Am I stating or summarizing your legal position accurately?
Yes, Your Honor, you are. And I think it's even more apparent, this issue is even more apparent with the less restrictive alternative. The district court judge appears to have used the civil commitment as a holding pattern instead of using it for the purposes for which it exists. And it is undisputed. There's nothing in this record that disputes that an IRTS setting is appropriate for Ms. Leonard. There is nothing in this record that disputes that placing her in that setting will protect her in all the ways that the county wishes to protect her. There is nothing in this record that suggests that it was going to take longer. In fact, the record is the opposite. The expert testifies, Dr. Marshall testifies, that typically it is faster to get into IRTS than it is into a hospitalization setting under civil commitment. And it's undisputed in this record that faster is better. That getting her out of the setting she was in that pre-commitment period into a more permanent placement is a better alternative. And so I think if the court goes through the record and undertakes that careful and searching examination, you simply do not find anything to support a finding that the less restrictive alternative is more appropriate in this case, and that the district court erred in rejecting that. And so while, yes, if the record were fuller and we had more evidence and more discussion of what occurred in lots of different places, I might be standing in front of you with a different argument that you should reverse and remand it because the findings are insufficient. But I think given the record, neither of those two elements are met here. And so this court should simply reverse it and remand it to the district court for an entirely new hearing because we're nearly five months down the road from when Ms. Lennard was, when the hearing occurred. So a new hearing should occur to find out how she's been doing in the commitment setting that she's in and what is the most appropriate remedy at that point. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Susan DeVos. I'm here today on behalf of Blue Earth County. And I'm here today asking this court to uphold the district court's decision committing Krista Lennard as a person who poses a risk of harm due to mental illness. The district court did comply with the commitment statutes under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 253B. And that decision by the district court is supported by findings based on the evidence that was before the district court. Those findings are not clearly erroneous, and I'm asking the court to uphold the decision. As Mr. White indicated, Ms. Lennard is not disputing today that she does have a substantial psychiatric disorder of thought, mood, perception, orientation, or memory that grossly impaired her judgment, behavior, capacity, or ability to recognize reality, and that it manifested itself in grossly disturbed behavior or faulty perceptions. It is of note, however, and I believe Mr. White noted it, that Ms. Lennard did dispute that at the hearing, and that's important because it's relevant to the least restrictive alternative that was appropriate under the circumstances.
But Ms. DeVos, getting back to the order itself, our court and the Supreme Court, multiple decisions have really emphasized the need for judges to make particularized findings and not simply to recite testimony. But would you agree that I'm looking at paragraph 5 of the findings of fact, because that seems to be kind of the critical one, not just by length, but because it focused on the one witness who testified, the examiner. But would you agree that is not a finding, a real factual finding? It's simply a recitation of what she said.
I would agree that the findings could have been clearer, that the court, it doesn't mention whether they whether the judge accepted her testimony as credible. I would agree with that, and whether that's a specific finding.
And the same with paragraph 9. Respondent has engaged in instances, that's simply quoting the statute. The problem we have with this order is nowhere do we see that the judge, for instance, was focusing on cutting or the burning, et cetera, as we look at the second factor, at least, of appellant's argument. And so what do we do with an order like this where we're just kind of left speculating on what the judge found credible or not credible? And moreover, as Mr. White indicates, talked about the history, which did Dr. Marshall did, but we have no history in the record. What do we do with that? How could we simply say, yes, it's supported when we don't know what's being supported?
I will concede that the written order is not detailed in its findings. There is evidence from the transcript itself. I know Mr. White has indicated concern with some of the statements, but those statements also indicate that the judge took into consideration Dr. Marshall's testimony as well as her written report. There is mention of the fire starting, it appears very clear from the oral record that, and the court did make its finding from the bench, so I would note that as well. I believe that there was some concern cited by Mr. White that the court simply signed the order fairly quickly within a few hours of that hearing. However, the court ruled from the bench and did note some specific information about the behaviors of Ms. Lenard that goes to the danger piece of it. And I believe that second prong, of course, is of import here today, given the argument that that wasn't met. I do want the court to note that the reference that the clearing...
Excuse just me. Before you move on, statute 253B.09 subdivision 2 requires specific findings by the court, and it says the court shall state the findings specifically and separately state its conclusion of law. And there's also a requirement that if so ordered, the finding shall also identify least less restrictive alternatives considered and rejected by the court and the reasons for rejecting each alternative. So in my reading of that language, it suggests to me that the statute contemplates written specific written findings. Is there any case that suggests oral findings are sufficient to satisfy that requirement?
I haven't found any specifically that would address that one way or the other, Your Honor.
Okay. And then with regard to the less restrictive alternative that was at issue here, the IRTS, the order doesn't include any discussion as to why that is any specific findings regarding why that is not appropriate. And explain to me why you think the order is sufficient in terms of meeting that statutory requirement, particularly given the court's comments at the hearing. I thought the court suggested that it thought that maybe it was appropriate.
Thank you, Your Honor. This commitment was a commitment to the Commissioner of Human Services, a full commitment, and not a direction that Ms. Lenard be placed at one particular facility. Under the commitment statute, you're not limited in placement. So Ms. Lenard could have been placed at an ERTS facility or a different facility as a result of that full commitment. The full commitment reflects the fact that the alternative of a stay of commitment, which is what was mentioned towards the end of Dr. Marshall, the court-appointed examiner's report, requires that a commitment respondent is willing to cooperate with conditions of a stay. In this case, Ms. Lenard, going to the first point that she needed to acknowledge that she did suffer from the mental illness, she wasn't even able to get to the point of acknowledging she had a mental illness.
Ms. DeVos, on that point, I think even Dr. Marshall testified and clarified that she wasn't even concerned with the fact she didn't that the respondent, Ms. Appellant, did not agree with the diagnosis, because apparently the treatment medication was the same for what she agreed she had, which was anxiety and perhaps depression and other things. And moreover, she testified, as did Dr. Marshall, that she was willing to cooperate. So aren't we back to, we still don't know why the judge rejected it, and so we can't really review that, because there is, the only evidence we have is that it would be successful, and the judge said no. And so we have no way of reviewing the reasoning for the judge, because as Judge Cochran indicated, there's no particular reasoning provided.
I would point the court to Dr. Marshall's actual testimony, where she does testify to the fact that she would be concerned if Ms. Leonard was not under a full commitment. It appears to backtrack somewhat from her written opinion, in which she indicates that a stay might be appropriate if she was cooperative. She indicates concern that it would place Ms. Leonard in danger. So given that, and then the court's recitation of the information that supported the commitment, I think that goes to the court's determination that the full commitment was the least restrictive appropriate alternative. Of course, it was an alternative, just not the appropriate alternative given the testimony that was before the court. Turning to that second,
I noticed, by the way, Ms. DeVos, you used the word "think," and I, the only reason I'm saying following up with that is you're surmising that's what the judge thought. Did I interpret that correctly?
I did say it, and that is certainly a issue with my statements today, and I should have just not done that. I agree. Saying "think" is a verbal tick. I do want to point out,
counsel, in committing Ms. Leonard to the commissioner for placement and as at such facility as the commissioner deems appropriate, that doesn't really answer the question as to whether there is a less restrictive alternative. Would you agree with that? I mean, you're saying it didn't foreclose, if I understand your argument, you're saying that commitment didn't foreclose placement at an IRTS, but the statute specifically requires consideration of less restrictive alternatives and rejection of those and if inappropriate and findings as to why they're inappropriate. So I guess I'm confused as to why you think that general order is sufficient to meet the requirement of the statute in terms of an analysis of less restrictive alternatives.
In terms of less restrictive alternatives that were being discussed at the hearing were an actual placement consideration was what Dr. Marshall was referencing. And when the court commits to the Commissioner of Human Services, the commissioner then decides based on bed availability, what would be appropriate for the individual that's been committed. If an individual, frankly, individuals aren't generally committed to an ERTS facility, for example, because there's no way to determine that that particular ERTS facility could take the individual, and because it's a community-based program. But so the general statement of committed to the Commissioner of Human Services allows that latitude. The least restrictive applies to whether there is another alternative outside of a full commitment. And the court
that is the stay versus the full commitment. Is that correct? That be correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And just, so there isn't a there is a paragraph that says a stay the petition and some other options are not appropriate, but there are not specific findings as to why not. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that they could have been more fully explained.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to get to one point that Mr. White referenced a few times. He referenced the need for the court to find that there was imminent harm. That's not the statute. Instead, the court has to find on that second prong that there's a substantial likelihood of physical harm to self or others. And then that would be demonstrated by a number of different options. One being a failure to obtain necessary food, clothing, shelter, and medical care due to the impairment or the mental illness. Two, the inability to meet those needs to obtain your necessary food, clothing, shelter, medical care due to the impairment. And that it was more probable than not that the person will suffer harm, significant psychiatric deterioration or debilitation or serious illness, unless appropriate treatment or services are provided. Another alternative is a recent attempt or threat to physically harm self or others, or recent and volitional conduct involving significant damage to substantial property. Here there were at least two that were met. There is demonstrated that she had the attempt or threat to physically harm self or others. Doesn't say there has to be another threat that's imminent. She did cut herself. That was undisputed. There was blood on her face that was witnessed. And again, not disputed.
Ms. DeVos, maybe that's what I wanted to narrow in on that, because we have the single incident in a store as alleged, and it's really repeated. The only evidence actually in the record, it's repeated in the examiner's statement. But what part of that is the threat? And again, this goes to the findings too, but I even just looking at the record, she has a cut, she has blood, she's admitting she's mentally ill, so it was a psychotic episode, and no one's disputing that. But isn't part of what, if I understand Mr. White's point, is by the time you get to a hearing, you have evidence that she's baseline, I think was what the doctor indicated, because now she's being treated again, and et cetera. So how do we derive from that evidence that she poses a substantial likelihood, which I assume you're arguing means she could do it again, harm herself? What in particular would you have us look at besides that one incident?
Sure. I believe that was noted by one of, I'm not sure if it was you earlier, Judge, but that she was being directed by a god. And that it was important too, because her actions, as demonstrated through the cutting of herself and smearing the blood, were directed by God and or a God, and her psychosis was essentially causing her to have these fears that then were manifested through that cut. So that was a demonstration of something that she had done, but she hadn't eliminated the force or the mental illness piece that was directing her. And it does go to the second option in terms of demonstrating substantial likelihood of physical harm is an inability, and I cite the inability rather than just the failure to obtain the care that she needed for her mental health, and that she did suffer harm then as a result of that in a deterioration of, excuse me.
May I ask one question?
Yes.
Judge Cochran?
You may. Go ahead.
If we disagreed with you regarding the findings in this case, what do you think the appropriate remedy would be? I think Mr. White has presented us with a number of different potential remedies. What do you think the appropriate remedy would be?
I would ask the court then to just remand for further findings rather than to discharge or dismiss the entire determination that Ms. Lennard is mentally ill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Do you want to briefly conclude, or are you done?
If the court will allow, I would just respectfully ask the court to affirm the district court's determination that Ms. Lennard did suffer and does suffer she does pose a significant harm to herself due to her mental illness. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me begin by addressing the remedy that the county suggested, which is to remand for additional findings. I think that is an insufficient remedy here, not only, especially in this particular case, but in general, this court has almost universally, when remanding a case, either due to insufficient findings or due to some other error, included in that remand a direction to the district court to allow additional testimony given the time that has passed. And we here would be in a situation where roughly 5 months have passed, during which Ms. Lennard has been under the full commitment. She has been in at least one treatment facility. And I think if you look at the district court record post-appeal, You'll see there's a notification that she was transferred to a different facility. But at any rate, she's been under care and treatment, and her circumstances have certainly changed. And this court has recognized...
Counsel, would that require a reversal and remand, or could we do as Ms. DeVos suggested, simply remand but allow the district court to reopen the record for additional findings?
Your Honor, I think you need to reverse it and remand it because given the nature of this record, there's simply insufficient evidence of the harm to self or others, and time permitting, I'll address that briefly. And the less restrictive alternative of a stay in IRTS is undisputedly a less restrictive alternative that Dr. Marshall felt was appropriate and would protect Ms. Lennard from the psychotic incident that she experienced and from which she had recovered. She had reached baseline, and that's the word that Dr. Marshall used. She had achieved baseline during the time period, even between the short period between when the incident occurred in Winona and when she was placed, or when the hearing occurred. I think a period of about 10 days. It might be 2 weeks, but it's an extremely short period when she recovers from that psychotic incident and becomes or reaches baseline again.
I have one other question regarding the remedies that you've asked for. I believe in your briefing, you ask us to assign a new judge, given the comments that were made about the previous relationship. Do you have any precedent or cases where we have assigned a new judge in that kind of situation?
I don't believe, I didn't do an extensive amount of research on that question, Your Honor. And I certainly think that there should be, as part of the remand, some kind of direction for the judge to at least disclose what that prior relationship may be. My assumption, and it's purely an assumption, is that there are prior cases involving Ms. Lennard in which the district court judge was involved. That doesn't particularly trouble me in the general circumstance, but here the problem I've got with this record is that all the judge says is, I know her, and as a result of that, along with the evidence at the hearing, I think that full commitment is appropriate. And A, the record doesn't support that, and B, we don't know what that prior history is that the judge is relying on. Because again, there's nothing in the record about any prior history, either with this particular judge or in general.
Just briefly turning back to the findings and whether they're sufficient, if we were to consider the ruling from the bench and the district court's discussion of its reasons as reflected in the transcript, would those reasons be sufficient findings to support the commitment?
No, Your Honor, because again, there's nothing in there where the judge says, and I find as a fact X, and I find as a second fact Y, and then Z, and so on through the alphabet as far as you want to go. Instead, the district judge simply talks about believing that placing Ms. Lennard in a hold through civil commitment is the best alternative here. And so even if you combine the oral statements by the judge with the written findings, I still don't think you have sufficient findings here under the statute, which requires specific factual findings and specific conclusions of law. But regardless of that, I think if the court undertakes that searching and careful examination of the record, you'll find that the record is simply insufficient here and that the appropriate remedy is to reverse the case, reverse the civil commitment, and remand the matter to the district court for further proceedings and whatever action the county wishes to take.
Okay. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments today. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.